Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
I'm talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We have mixed market this morning, very, very light. S&P futures down $1.15, NASDAQ futures down up 6. So not much going on. The Fed meeting is today. Oh, well, actually the Fed announcement and news conference today. The meeting's been for 2 days. Not expected to lower rates, which should elicit yet another he's an idiot from the president. But I suspect they're probably going to announce that they are planning on lowering rates a couple times this year. That seems to be the consensus. We will see. It looks to me like they're pouring a lot of money in the economy, which is really the main story that nobody, everybody's been directed not to talk about for the last 15 years. Doesn't matter who's in office. They're not supposed to look at money supply anymore, even though we know that that is really kind of the thing that drives it all, and the money supply is going up. We'll see this month if the May, well, actually, the what do we get? We'll get the April numbers, because we can't be trusted to have the current numbers, although we know other people are getting them. You know, it's just kind of an interesting world. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Morning.
You can't handle the money supply numbers, Mr. O'Neill.
The only money supply that matters to me is when I check my wallet before I walk out of the house to see if I have cash or not.
I think you're right on that. Of course, if you were younger, you wouldn't worry about any cash.
Yeah, well, I tell people you always have to carry at least some baseline of cash because cash can get you out of problems.
Maybe you should mention that to our producer, Mr. Andrew.
Andrew, cash can get you out of trouble sometimes. As simple as a flat tire or, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, but you also might have to pay once in a while.
Well, yeah, we do. Nobody makes you pay cash anymore.
No, but I mean, what if it's a, you know, cash only bar, and all of a sudden you don't have any? Hey guys, hey guys.
Yeah, I can walk out of a bar.
Yeah, that's true. I can't believe. Well, actually, you know, it's there's a restaurant here. You ever been to a used to be called the Vernon Park Tap, and it's been Tofano's for a long time after that, over by UIC.
In Chicago since the early 90s.
Well, I mean, it's been, you come in here from time to time, and I've actually seen your bot at restaurants with you. But anyway, it's a place, they still only take cash. There's a couple of bars around Wrigley, I think, that still only take cash, too.
You know, I run into people who say they only want to take cash because they don't want to pay the credit card fees, so.
Plus, you can, I won't say hide a little bit, but also, if it's your ATM, you get the fees from the ATM. So you're actually getting the credit card fees.
Oh, the ATM fees are a little bit more complicated than that. Whether it's the credit card or the ATM or whatever, there's a settlement as to who owns it, but there's also the card issuer gets a skin, and you know it all gets tracked by the clearing network, and they get a month-end settlement telling them here you net owe or you net earn.
I think you can put. This is a long time ago. I think you can feed cash into the cash machine.
You probably still can, but I think you're crazy if you do.
Well, I think it's a way to get your cash into the bank, essentially, without having to carry it over there if you're a cash-only place.
Dispensaries are cash-only places.
I mean, I know some people used to own a Popeyes franchise. And they would take their cash from the Popeyes and put it in the machine. So if somebody went in there and took $200 out, the machine, it's now in your bank account without you having to lug the $200 and 20s over there.
So you say you know somebody who had a Los Pollos Hermanos?
Well, it was a Popeyes, ye
in Minnesota. For those of you who don't get the Breaking Bad reference.
No, I actually didn't. But,
That was a good way to launder drug money.
Yeah, well, it's we used to be dry cleaners and pizza joints, right? Chinese places. People paid cash. Anyway, what about these NBA playoffs? This is the third round now that has been marred by an injury to a star late in the series. First, it was.
You think it might be a problem if we ask people to play 80, 90 games in a season, whatever we ask them to play?
It's 80 games. It's 80 games, and they're on, if you're still playing, I think it's your 21st or 22nd playoff game. So we're up to 100
I think we care about the safety of the athletes.
No. Whoever. Well, we do to the extent that if we have a guaranteed contract, we do. But, you know, they got to earn their keep, right?
It's insured.
That's what when you see. This is going back a ways. When you see contracts, the greatest one was probably was Red Grange with manhole cover George Halas, and they allegedly paid Red Grange like all this money, right? Okay, they did, but then they went out on like a barnstorming tour to play people so they get money to pay him. So he essentially had him earn his own salary. Same thing happened with a totally different note. Kevin was Howard Stern. When he went on satellite, they didn't have the cash to pay him. If he brought enough advertisers and stuff with him, which evidently he did, then they had the money to pay him. But it wasn't like they were gonna pay him even if it was a bust. I mean, he had if he didn't elevate, I'll use the term, the league or the station up, they didn't have a chance. They were going to pay him.
It's Caitlin Clark nowadays.
Yeah, well, but does she make that much?
Well, she's according to the collective bargaining agreement restrictions, but they have it coming up at the end of this year, and the sudden jolt she gave the league last year and things like TV ratings and such were they were banking on being able to convert that into a much better agreement, the Players Association was. Then she got hurt for,
2 weeks.
5-6 games. Yeah, a couple of weeks.
Yep.
And the TV ratings plummeted.
You couldn't give away the tickets over at the United Center when she wasn't playing.
That's right. And now she's back. So we'll see how it goes. You got one person who's earning everybody's paycheck and or who they're hoping will, and yet at the same time they really don't seem to like her very much.
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on there. You know, people think that she doesn't deserve to get paid, and they do, and they're just as good, and blah blah blah. I mean, there's a lot of entitlement.
There's a certain pay homage to the people who set the table here, and some really really great players from the past who never were able to draw interest. But Clark draws interest somehow like nobody else. She's a great player. She's fun to watch. She's kind of chippy in her own right. She got up against the limit last year for technicals when you have to sit out for a game. She reminds me a little of John Stockton. Great player, but when everybody picked the dirtiest player in the league, teams, Stockton was always on it. Because he just was you walk on the court, he's not the same guy. He's not a really really nice guy.
Well, there's the degrees of playing hard, and it is interesting when you go through sports. Some sports seem to handle the person who's the star a little better, and some sports don't, and some people don't. You know, some people are just insanely jealous. The simple fact is, it's not you. I mean, I loved when I was younger. I loved to play golf, and Arnold Palmer ruled the world. I mean, his audience was three times anybody else's, and then later on it became Tiger Woods. And you know what? You either get carried along, you get carried along by the tide, and make a hell of a lot more than before the guy got here, or you bitch about it the whole way. And I think you're better off being carried by the tide, eh?
You probably are. But I could see, I could see a player like Asia Wilson, who had been the, part of it is that while Clark brought a lot of new fans to the game, I sort of understand the thought process on this for some of the players. It doesn't mean that you're wrong, because you are right. Being gracious is probably the way to go. You know, Wilson, for what, 4 or 5 years, has been the best player on the planet, and not getting all that much recognition for it. Okay, fine. You know, I know the popularity of the sport has a whole lot to do with it, the relative popularity of the sport. And so, and then along comes Caitlin Clark. Well, she brings this legion of fans who, you know, to maybe exaggerate a little bit, think that Caitlin Clark invented basketball, and that, you know,
and, well,
you know, that kind of stings. You know, I've seen that with some of the like college athletics. You know, a team comes out of nowhere and gets good, and all of a sudden their fan base acts like that. Yeah, we invented football. We know all about it. We'll tell you all what's the right ways to do things and the wrong ways to do things. That never goes over well.
Well, it doesn't, but it's also, I think there's a lot of things in life. You got to
turn into Mike Ditka now.
I played a lot of so have you. We've played a lot of sports, and you know, the idea that you have such a friggin' ego that not only do you think you're good and your sport is good, but other people, if they only had a brain cell working, would pay a lot of money to come out and watch you play. Well, you know what? That's just an ignorant way to look at things. I mean, it's all about pizzazz. I mean, I used to go once in a while. Boy, I was never really good enough, because I was not good at three wall. But I was a pretty good handball player, but I wasn't that good at three wall because my left hand was kind of weak. But anyway, there were some of the best athletes I've ever come encountered that were terrific handball players. I think some of the best athletes we've ever come across happen to be guys that worked all day in a factory and were soccer players. They were strong as an ox, fast as could be. Never had a chance to play any other kind of ball. It was terrific stuff. Now, if all of a sudden somebody of note retired from Major League Baseball or did something else, or Michael Jordan, instead of going to play baseball, decided to play 16-inch softball, and all of a sudden you go to Kelly Park or Clarendon Park and there's 10,000 people are watching Michael Jordan playing softball and paying to get in. You know what? It's on him. I mean, it's just the way the world is, Kevin. You can't. There's always going to be how many people slugged around playing football until there was a Red Grange? I mean, that's just the way the world is. I mean, look at the purses before and after Arnold Palmer and before and after Tiger Woods. I mean, there were an awful lot of guys that were great golfers, but that's just not the way it works, is it? I mean,
I think the difference in feeling is that people could at least recognize that whether they like the Tiger phenomenon or not, whether they like the Arnold phenomenon or not, there was no denying that he was the best player out there.
Palmer was,
issues come in with the WNBA players, because you know, she comes in the league and she's really good, but she's not the best player out there.
She's pretty close.
You know, yeah, and if she isn't, she will be.
Yeah,
I have no doubt about that. But you know, when you look at, you know, a Wilson, or you look at some of the people that have been around, Brianna Stewart, you know, some of those players, they're really, really good. They're every bit as good as Clark, if not better, at this point. Now, you know, experience has a lot to do with it. It's a different game than college. It's more physical. You know, so there's a lot of that that comes into play. But you know, you don't. You know, I think there was a really strong feeling that everybody anointed her the best player ever before, and they're sitting there looking, saying, what's wrong with us?
Well, Kevin, it's been going on for how many years? I feel like I don't feel like Socrates. I'm not a smart word. You got to worry about the younger generation. Mm-hmm. How many people have you sat and watched a game with in the last 30 years that knows nothing about football, nothing about baseball, and they watch somebody run a kickback, and they go, "That's the guy. He's the best player ever." He's what? You know, I mean, if you see somebody and you like him, he's the best ever. I mean, it's the mentality, you know, of a lot of people. Maybe always have been, but I just don't get there's a leap here, in that I love to see people play handball. I think lacrosse, you know, I guess if we would have played it, maybe we'd have liked to have played it. I think, you know, women should be able to play a sport and enjoy themselves playing sports as much as guys. And I think that their teams, they're kind of fun to watch or whatever, but it drops to the point where, no, Chief, you should go pay to watch somebody play handball. You need to go watch women's basketball. And by the way, pay for this ticket. You need to go watch lacrosse. No, I don't. They're just a bunch of people enjoying themselves playing sports. I mean, it doesn't mean that I have to give them my money. I mean, it's okay. It's just not something. I don't want to watch somebody else play handball. I want to play handball.
I agree that it is entirely too foolish to have a meal ticket that's there for you and to treat her like they treat her. I think they go way too far on it. I think they're and I just think it's really, really dumb.
Well, if one of them manages the herder, where are they?
It's one of those things. I'm sorry, what did you just say?
So if one of them happens to herder, seriously, where are they? Back where they were.
Well, look, I watched Marina Mabry, the clip of Marina Mabry giving her a shove and knocking her to the floor yesterday. That is in the lines of, along the lines of, you know, what if someone knocks her to the floor?
Well, yeah. It's a rough game.
I happen to be a big Marina Mabry fan. She's a former Notre Dame star and a really good player in the WNBA. Plays really hard, plays really tough, very competitive. You know, everybody as competitive as any guy I've ever seen. But I sat there and looked and go, what are you doing? What is wrong with you?
Well, I mean, it basketball, for those that haven't played it, is a rough game. I mean, when you talk about being in condition for playing basketball, everybody says, well, you got to be able to run up and down the floor. Yeah, you do. But when I was playing in some pretty decent leagues, it's not the running back and forth that I could do all night. It's leaning up against a guy bigger than you on one end or the other and essentially having a weight workout at each end and then running. I mean, if you didn't touch anybody, I mean, maybe the guards don't touch anybody. But actually, boy, the NBA, no. Everybody touches everybody. I mean, it's physical as all get out.
This was dead ball.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, everybody talking, and she just comes over and just goes and blasts her.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a little odd.
Yeah. She got a technical. Not a flagrant, just a technical.
Not sure where that is.
The league is complicit in this as well. I don't know what they're thinking.
You don't think it's a white versus black thing, do you?
No, because they're both white.
Oh, well. Because, I mean, clearly when Michael and Scotty had it out for Tony Kukoc, I think there was a chunk of that in there.
Yeah, I think that was aimed at, that was more about Reinsdorf than anything.
Well, maybe. But because they beat the hell out of him in the Olympics.
Or, excuse me, Jerry Krause than anything.
But, I mean, they beat the hell out of him in the Olympics. Was he even considered, he wasn't even a bull then.
No, but he was the apple of Jerry Krause's eye, and that did not go over well.
Why do you suppose? I mean, the numbers in basketball seems like
a lot of that was because they didn't like Jerry Krause. So no,
yeah, he picked them.
Amazing, huh? He didn't pick Jordan.
Who drafted him? Was the guy before Krause?
I think it was Rod Thorne.
Yeah. Well, he kind of fell to him. The first round pick ahead of Jordan was probably the right pick. The second pick, the team had who the hell did they have? They had already a guy like Jordan.
They had Drexler.
Yeah, and they said we don't really know two guys like that. Although it would be pretty tough to cover, wouldn't it? Those two guys were on the same team.
They would have been very difficult, as we saw when they played together on the Dream Team.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Sam Bowie was a really good player. He was just hurt nonstop. So he didn't happen because he kept getting injured. So that makes it all the worse because everybody said, well, they drafted Sam Bowie. Who's ever heard of him? He was, you know, he was considered the top player coming out of high school when he went to Kentucky. And the only admonishment I would have about that particular pick was that Bowie had been hurt a couple of times in Kentucky, too. So, you know, you get to a point where you say, do I really want to risk number two pick in the draft and a guy who might be brittle?
Well, some people, when you grow that fast and you're whatever the hell you are, 7 feet or 6'11", you can have issues growing up that, you know, then you don't have afterward. You know, but some people, they just keep coming. Once you hurt something else. And how do you ever really know?
Olajuwon, on the other hand, yeah, he was just as big, probably a little more filled out. But I don't ever recall him having a serious injury.
What no, he was play. He was one hell of a player for a lot of years. And sort of interesting. I mean, the sports are definitely a microcosm of of human nature, aren't they? I mean, at all levels. Well, how far, how high do you think?
Part of what I like about it, it is a business, it is a competition, it is, you know, we can get to the cue the wide world of sports. It's, you know, the human drama, all of that is there, and yet it's there and bare for everybody to see. You know, all the same kinds of human nature things happen inside a business, or inside any large organization. They all happen, but we don't get to see them publicly.
Well, we don't in a business either.
Yeah, no, we don't get to see them publicly, and that's the point. Whereas in sports, we do. It's all bare, and it's kind of interesting. You know, we're seeing the same thing with, you know, the Devers situation. And you talk about, you know, he's 2 years. He's in second year of a 7-year contract. They kind of bet the whole franchise on him. And they can't find a place for him to play because they signed Bregman. He was going to be their third baseman, but then they signed Alex Bregman the following year. And they're trying to convince him to play other positions. He doesn't want to do it. And so they finally say, well, let's wash our hands of this. We should be able to get some really good prospects, which they did. And then he goes to the press conference in San Francisco yesterday before he played his first game and said, yeah, I'll play wherever they want me to be. They're the decision makers, not me. How's that for just, you know, a good middle finger back to Boston?
Well, it's dealing with and scouting your own people is one of the most hardest things to do in sports for some reason. And I don't know why that is so much, Kevin. But didn't what is it, the team of the first team to hire somebody in baseball to actually scout your own people? I mean, it's Fred Sanford say one man's junk is another man's treasure. I mean, it really does happen with people in sports, and you never really know, do you? I mean, it's the thing that I think a lot of we've been talking about, you know, women's this and college that. I think what's happening, and you again in Stocks and Jacks, I always try to tie all this stuff together. I've kind of noticed the last month or so, Kevin, because. You know, I have people I meet out, clients and so forth, and Audrey and I usually go out on a weekend, and I've noticed a serious drop-off in, you know, again, it's summer, you know, there was graduations, there's all kinds of mitigating circumstances, but serious drop-off in the places that we normally go. Now, sure enough, yesterday in the retail sales number, one of the bigger hits was in restaurants and bars, and I wonder... When you look, if you look at, say, Wrigley Field, which is, you know, about as successful as it gets in selling tickets, I think I read, Kevin, you know, kick me if I'm wrong, is it 60% or 65% of the tickets, people there, they didn't buy the ticket? Either a corporation or somebody else?
I believe it. I didn't know that, but I'll believe it.
Now, you know, it could be that they're sharing seats with somebody else, and depending how you define stuff, as you and I age, you know, you can define anything in the way you want it to make it sound like you want it to, right? But I guess my question is, if you look at the walk-up crowd any one of these games, how many people just say, oh, man, it's 5 o'clock, I feel pretty good today, looks like the weather's nice. I don't know if you can, I guess you can still get into a Cub game. I'll go down to Comiskey or whatever, Rate Field, and watch the Sox game. I'm going to say that number is as close to zero as it's ever been. And that used to be the entire gate, really, right? I mean, there's always a few people, I guess, going back that had season tickets, but not very many. And the question is, what's going to cause, you know, 50 firms in Chicago to all of a sudden have to have 4 seats to women's basketball or something else or lacrosse or something? I don't see that. I mean, if you didn't have any of that stuff at the Cub game, matter of fact, take a look at it. Boy, this is be interesting. Next time, well, we don't have a show tomorrow, so we won't have Wayne and Andrew. But I'm going to say, those guys seem to know a lot about this stuff. When I went to see the Nationals play, well, first of all, when they built the stadium, what was that 20 years ago, Kevin? They got the team back from Montreal, right? So they built a stadium. It's at the end of the Metro thing. Other than that, there's kind of nothing there. Well, probably is now, but when I went, there was kind of nothing around there. And the so they were having as close to physical fist fights as you could have, and every lobbyist firm, every law firm, everybody had to have a skybox at this place. Everybody had a 4 or 6 or 8 of the best tickets you could find, blah, blah, blah. And when I went out there, they must have all given them to the people in Washington that are working. High percentage of them are ladies, and from what I hear, I've never worked out there. Most people are pretty good looking. Well, I go to watch a Cub game one night. I never saw in my life, ever before or since, a selection of women from age 25 to 35. It had to be 80% ladies in all the good seats. So obviously all these people just, they gave their tickets away every night. Well, now, when the Cubs were out there a couple weeks ago, the place is empty, Kevin. I can't believe these people gave up their tickets. They can't even give them away, or maybe they did give them up. I don't know. Maybe after 15 years.
Remember, they weren't entirely empty, but all the good seats were empty.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So these are tickets that people have and don't even bother to give them away. Or maybe the tickets are so friggin' expensive that it's considered a gift that you have to register for and get and everything else, to the point where people drive. When we used to clear through Mesro, I talk about a goat bleep. Our guy, Jimmy Tyree, had tickets on the folding chairs on the floor at the old stadium. Actually, it might have been the United Center.
Yeah,
the folding stores. Not the ones by the bench, the other side. And so he goes, hey, would you want to... I've got 2 tickets. You want to go? And I go, sure. And this is back when he actually had a ticket, which I didn't mind going. So all of a sudden, the guy gets deathly ill, right? Now, the ticket is... This is a long time ago, Kevin. We were still at Mesro. Ticket was $750. So, which is way above something you can give to somebody, even if it's a client, without... But if you go with somebody, then it's okay. So I can't just say if PTI had 4, $200 tickets to Wrigley Field, I can go with you, but I can't just give them to you. And by the way, if you're in a law firm or something, you better say you got it as a gift. Okay, so we haven't kept up with that. I think the number might have gone up from $50 to $100 or something. That's why nobody gives gifts anymore. It's such a pain in the ass to if you want to do it right, they would say I got a gift from this guy or that guy. All of a sudden, my buddy gets deathly ill. So the people at Mesro are calling their attorneys in New York, like rousting them out on a Saturday, saying, what do we do with these tickets? Finally, the guy says, just tell them to take a buddy, for God's sake. So we went. Larry and I went. I mean, but it was such a major hassle just to give us the damn tickets. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, you can't get up and go get your own beer, so you get your guy. Shows up and says, I'm your guy to go get your beer, right? Okay, well, that's cool. Because the last thing I want you to do is get up in the middle of play and start walking down the side of the court with a beer, right? So you got to sort of sit there if there's not a timeout. But it was fun because first half was kind of just your basic first half early in the year in basketball. And all of a sudden, the second half, the guys start crashing into each other a little bit, and the ref comes by, and I go, Looks like the action's picking up. He goes, yeah, looks like I got to go to work. He says to me, okay then. He goes, yeah, looks like I got to go to work now. First half, nobody touched anybody. But it was fun. I mean, I can't imagine paying, $1,500 a night for a ticket. Not what do you think they are now? $2,000 or something? I have no idea.
I wouldn't have any idea. Yeah, when bank I worked at the time had 4 tickets, so I'd get to go once in a while. And just being down that low and watching a fast break with Jordan Pippen and Horace Grant on it was like nothing I had ever seen on a basketball court before. Those guys were so fast, that ball would be down the court in about a second and a half.
And they're so big and they're so fast.
It's so big, so fast, long strides. It was just incredible to watch them. A little side story, our retail manager, was kind of before branch banking, so we really could only have a couple of branches within a certain amount of space. But our retail manager at the time just she worked for the Bulls as a side hustle because she liked basketball, and she would be one of the people who would bring the stats to everybody after the quarter at halftime and so on, the stat package for the beginning of the game. And so she would always make an extra stop by the bank seats and give everybody a copy of them. And so we're sitting there, you know, looking at them, and the guy sitting, you know, not with us, that was sitting there, said, so we're, you know, what's that? And I said, oh, it's the stat package. You want to see? And I hand it to him, and then his buddy looks in and goes, where'd you get that? And he says, well, you have to know somebody.
Well, isn't that the way it is? We don't want nobody sent, right?
That's right.
You ever use that line?
I haven't, but I know the line.
That's a, what do you, it appears, Kevin, I think that we're in danger of running this inflation up even more. If we start getting a couple of retail sales, things like this, and, you know, part of it is supply and demand. I think the, you know, it's sort of a wacky habit of mine. I keep tab of used trucks. When I got nothing to do for an hour, I look around for used trucks. The if anything is priced anywhere near normal, it's gone in like a day, no matter where it is. Could be in Oregon, it's gone. And the constant, and one of the things in the retail sales number yesterday was a drop in new car sales. Now, whether it's tariff related, not related, you would think it would have been higher because it would have been before the tariffs. But car sales are so, I use the term ubiquitous. It's stunning to me, and don't think I'm a car dealer or anything, but how many people have zero clue how cars are actually priced and how it all works out and how the financing ties in and stuff. Yet everybody, have you ever met anybody who bought a car that didn't get a deal? They all think they put one over on the dealer. How the hell is that? I mean, really?
I will say this. My car, I got a deal. It's getting to be time to start looking again for it. But I got a deal during COVID. When all of the rental car companies...
Okay, that can happen, yep.
They were dumping their product in the market. So later during all that lockdown crap, later on, they start, you know, it started to... the prices started to run up real quickly. But right away, when they knocked dumped it all down, local dealership had a whole fleet, and their owner wanted to get rid of them. So I was able to get a really, really cheap 30,000-mile car. That aside, I have the previous cars I bought from the no negotiation dealers. This is our price. This is it. Take it or leave it. And I always felt like it was, it was a reasonably good price, and so let's go with it. That to me is a much more not normal shopping experience. So I'd like to think that I would be really good at going into a dealer's and sitting down and getting into the whole negotiation process, and it'd be really, really good at it. I'm fine with just saying, tell me what it costs, let's go.
But so you just went in and bought the car?
Yeah.
Right, do you know how rare that is?
Yeah, very.
No, what I'm saying is virtually everybody has a trade-in.
Oh, I had a trade-in too. It wasn't worth very much at that point.
Okay, but if you know it's worth nothing, and they give you nothing. That's what I'm saying. Most people... don't the transaction, and they all still owe money. When I say all, this is every man. That's not everybody. Most people still owe money on their old car. Sometimes they're underwater. That's why your list price, and that's why there's this massive negotiation, is because you get essentially three transactions going at the same time: new car, old car, financing, all that stuff's all involved, and oh, by the way, paying off your old loan. Actually, it's four transactions. It gets very complicated, and people think they got the upper hand there, and they don't. I mean, it's not that people are cheating you. They don't. It can be very competitive, but there's a lot of stuff going on. So even if every dealer knows that next month, say there's going to be $3,000 tariff on every car, the idea that you're going to go in and nobody, that the current price is going to rise up to equal to $3,000. It's not going to be, oh man, if you buy it today, you get it $3,000 cheaper. If you wait 2 weeks, it's going to be $3,000 more. Because he's going to look out in a lot and he goes, I only got 10 cars and I got 15 people in the showroom. I can raise this $500, $1,000, $1,500 right now and then still say, boy, it's better than a tariff, which it is. don't think for a second it's going to be the full $3,000 cheaper, right? I mean, it's just not the way the world works. And that's how, I mean, you know, people in business are do what if you're if you've got 10 cars available and normally you're 10% off list and you got 100 people in the showroom looking like they need a car, you're not coming 10% off list, Kevin, are you?
I didn't think so.
But in COVID, we were paying what? $4,000 over list.
Yes. That if you really wanted to pay close attention and see when you could get a deal, is you just want to look at the inventory on the lot on a regular basis, because inventory costs money. They're paying, you know, they're paying interest on those shop floor or what do they call them?
Well, it depends.
Paying interest on they're financing it too. So
some are, some don't. Back in the day, GM, the dealer always financed. That's where GM made most of their money, is interest for dealers through GMAC. And the because it's funny, Audrey's uncle was South Side dude. You'd have loved him, Kevin. Really, really hard worker.
South Side, never would have guessed it.
Yeah, I mean, he bought Hollingshead Oldsmobile when old man Hollingshead died, and he bought it from the widow, and it was I think he paid her $1.5 million for the place. I think she loaned him like $1.4 million, and he paid her back the first year with interest. So he has the place, and he was one of the, you know, if you had a car that was 3 years old and you brought it in for service, and you know, and the guy said, well, you need this, and you know, and fix it up a little bit, he'd call you the next week. Hey, Kevin, I hear you're in service. The thing's starting to go on you. You don't want me doing that. I got one coming in. The color your wife's like, the last three cars, got everything you want on it. I'll give you a great deal. Drive that one in. Drive the new one home tonight. I mean, but he never didn't pay for a car who was on the lot. So in GMAC's eyes, he was a pariah. Yet whenever a dealer would get in trouble somewhere, they'd ask him if he'd go out there for a week, and they'd pay him as a consultant to help the guy out. It almost always was, hey, you got too many friggin' cars you can't sell. I mean, if you're going to go out and put cars on the lot, you have to have an amazing eye for what people want. You're not going to put some crazy color out there you can't sell. You're not going to buy, in those days, you're not going to get one with air conditioning nobody wants. It's really difficult to order cars. Back in those days, there were a million options that people want. It's so much easier to just say, hey, Kevin, how about I order you one up just like you like it? It'll be here in 6 weeks or 4 weeks. Okay. Or I got one coming in. I know your wife will love the color. I mean, it's a business like anything else, and the price is very negotiable. I mean, how many people that you've talked to, like when I worked at Allied Van Lines, the young ladies, they're terrific, terrific people. They have a junky old car. And the one lady, she comes in, hey, Tommy, want to see my new car? Sure. She got this newer car. I mean, the old one wasn't the greatest, and this one, you know, was just newer. And she goes, it's terrific. She just got maybe a $100, $200 a week raise or something. She got, you know, went from the secretary pool to being somebody's secretary. So she walked in, and she was paying, that at those days, you know, $100 a month in the old one. She walks in, she sees this car, and she goes, well, I really like that. And he goes, well, where's your old one? She points to it, and he goes, how much are you paying now? $100 a month. How much can you pay now? Well, $125. If I can get you in that car for $125 a month, we got a deal? And she goes, yeah. And then she goes, drives it home, happy as a clam. I said, her name was Cheryl. I go, Cheryl, how much did you pay for it? I have no idea. How much you get for your old one? I have no idea. All I know is I was paying $100, now I got a new car, it's $125, and 3 years from now I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going, okay then. You know, who was I to criticize, Kevin? He was happy, she was happy, everybody's happy.
No business.
But that's not you. You're going to know exactly how much you want to pay for the new one, exactly how much you give me for the old one. By the way, there's no loan to worry about. Let's just do business. That's some percentage of the population, not a high one. Because most people come in, hey, your old car is worth $10,000. By the way, you owe 12. Okay, so instead of paying 50 with a list price of 59, you're going to pay 52. You're going to finance 52, and everybody's happy, right? Pay off the old loan. Got the new
Somebody's
car, off you go.
Than everybody else, though.
What?
But there's always somebody who's happier than everybody else.
Well, but I mean, it's what they do. You're the guy who has a $12,000 loan on a car that's worth $10,000. That's not his fault, right?
Yeah, no. I think when you walk away from a business deal when everybody's happy, unless somebody is unwittingly screwed, which I'm sure happens, but for the most part, when you say this is what I can afford, this is the car I want, and you can get it, and the dealer says I can do that deal, then cool, good for everybody. That's commerce.
What if this retail sales thing is not just a one month encounter? I mean, I think, Kevin, if with some of the layoffs we've seen, and I don't think we'll see this month if there are anything that is next month's labor stuff. We'll see if any of that is filtering through, or if it will. People could be getting hired somebody else. That would be the idea. We start seeing this drop and what people are spending because of stuff being a little more expensive. I don't know, Kevin. If we start seeing interest rates sneaking up a little bit, I don't know how much slack there is left in every man. I'm always worried about, what can somebody, how much blood can you get out of the turnip, as the Irish would say.
Well, there hasn't been any slack for a long time. Now if we start to see too many layoffs, isn't that what we saw in 2007-08?
Yeah.
It was one thing that people were probably financed. Well, not probably, people were financed more than they should have been, and a lot of stuff, a lot of their mortgages, for example, a lot of the home equity loans that people used to buy things like cars were all ready to reprice to a higher rate. But in addition to that, people were losing their jobs and saying, I can't pay for this, I can't even qualify for a refi. They told me I could just refi my balloon when it comes up, and everything would be fine. And in the meantime, I have this wonderful low rate. And then you get up to refi time, and they're saying, "Sorry, you ain't working. I can't give you a loan." And we had so many layoffs in early 2008. This area, Elkhart County over here, was like 20.5 unemployment rate.
Well, we just
imagine that one out of every five people who wanted a job could not get a job.
Sounds like the. Sounds like Gaza. Well, that's one out of three. When we first started the show, Maddie Weber's, Maddie's was of the age at that time where they was just kind of out of college and everybody had his job. And, Maddie always managed to attract nice looking ladies and a lot of them were played on our softball team and so forth. And virtually everybody, male and female, that had graduated college in like a marketing degree or something, these are all very presentable, male and female, all look good, dress decent. Virtually all of them, not all of them, I would say well over half in these these new marketing jobs or whatever you want to call those kinds of things, PR and so forth, they're all laid off for about 6 months to a year. And, there was people scooting back with their parents and all kinds of stuff was happening. And, and if you've got a place to go back and land, I guess that's okay. But if you just got a mortgage and you don't have any parents, now you got a problem, right? It was underneath the veneer of things not being that bad. It was pretty bad for a lot of people. And, now you're starting to see, because a lot of people aren't getting mortgages at these rates. I mean, the idea that the housing prices have gone from whatever they were 5 years ago, say 300,000 to 400,000, when the rates have gone from 3 to 6 or more, maybe even 7, to think that math doesn't work out for individual people is really crazy. I mean, it does. It affects everybody. Now, people can't afford a house. Well, guess what? The apartments are to the moon. And what's happening with some of these apartments, in order to make sure you only get the, quote, right people there, Some of the apartments are, if the rent is $2,500, they want somebody's gross income to be three times that per month. God's sake, Kevin, how many people do you know make $7,500 a month? I mean, we don't people like that, but I'm saying in general, how many people make $90,000 a year just to get an apartment? I mean, I would say that $90,000 is probably the top. What, it's the top 20% maybe? 25, that's being generous. One person, I'm not talking about a family, I'm talking, because what's the median salary, 41? So yeah, 90.
I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but yeah, it just doesn't work. And it starts cascading through, and that's what we saw. And what really, really lit it in 2008 was all of a sudden fuel prices ran up.
Yeah.
You know, that happened early in the year. And so that's why it was so bad over here, is because we were so dependent on the RV industry. And those things not good with fuel. So RVs and boats, both.
Well,
so
what's happened here is your utility bills are to the moon. And I just can't, I can't, maybe on Friday we'll kick it around a little bit, Kevin. This whole Madigan situation, I mean, I'm not an attorney. The guy's supposedly going to go away for 7.5 years. Yet, it was never a criminal case for the place that bribed him. And, oh, by the way, the increases in your electric bill that supposedly wouldn't have happened if he didn't get bribed, or else why would you care, right? None of those are being rescinded. So what am I missing here? Am I just an old fart in the wind here, or what? I mean, don't they all sort of go together?
Thank you for that.
I mean, shouldn't they sort of go together? As my electric bill goes up every month? I mean, if somebody was really bribed to get that rate increase in, why should I pay the rate increase? Or is that just my Southside Catholic person talking?
No, I absolutely agree with you on that one. That's, you know, it's almost a no-brainer. Why on earth is one a criminal and the other one is just, just a liability? And so that doesn't make sense to me. I agree with you. Where I think we, you know, again, looking back at 2008, I think it was more grassroots than that. Yes, we all had problems with the kinds of things that were happening, the inequities in the economy. And Barack Obama certainly did a really, really fine job of, tapping into that. But that wasn't the sum total of it. I think the most of it was just that it was a very, very human type of drama at play, where people just couldn't make ends meet in any way, shape, or form. And they had, you know, the smart economic move was, you got a house, walk away from it. You know, it's gonna, you know, the loan, if you can get a loan, the loan is way higher than the value of the home, because there was so much inventory dumped onto the market. And people were, you know, just folding.
And I would,
it wasn't pretty at all. Prices were up because every shipper had a fuel escalator built into their contracts. So that, you know, that was not working well either. That was causing people outside of the directly affected industries, for fuel prices. That was causing other companies to bust or to severely curtail production. You know, there was so much going on, and I still would like to know a little more about what was behind that fuel price run up. That never was adequately explored, and I don't know if there was a who behind it, or if it just was a circumstance of the market.
Well, it's pretty hard, Kevin. Hopefully a Russell on the line. I want to address one thing you mentioned about the 2008 situation. I'm not sure. Let's sneak back. I always thought that, despite people's views of it, the oil industry is about as competitive as we have these days in big businesses. I mean, there's all kinds of people that export oil, all kinds of people that refine. I mean, not as many as maybe used to be, but compared to some businesses, it's pretty damn competitive. I mean, now you can do stuff like, let's go with the summer blend, which means that only two refineries in Chicago make it, and all of a sudden we're paying 30 cents more. I mean, you can have governmental, people's nose up government's ass to pull stuff like that off. I mean, that happens. But a general sort of thing, if it's not the Saudis or somebody, and even OPEC doesn't have that kind of power. Let's kind of kick that around on Friday, but hopefully I have Russell. Maybe he can disagree with me here or something. But the thing that's, in my opinion, that set 2008 apart, and you and I have lived through, well, not a real lot, but a lot of recessions. And recession is somewhat of a normal thing of the business cycle where everything's going good, people overinvest, a bunch of stuff, and then all of a sudden there's too much investment, too much production maybe, and prices come down a little bit, and all of a sudden people, you'll see a factory go from three shifts to two shifts, and then all of a sudden it gets down, people retrench, and it comes back up. It's almost part of human nature. It's not terrific, but generally, you know, you might get laid off for a couple of weeks or a month, and maybe you can go do something else, maybe you can't. But you know, and it's not good. But two times that I know about, one I would live through, and one I read about, is the Depression and the 2008 fiasco. To me, were different because they weren't income recessions; they were balance sheet recessions. In the Depression, you know, Grandpa O'Neill and Grandpa Chief, he was laid off from the railroad. Okay, but the problem was Grandpa O'Neill and Grandpa Chief, I don't know if he ever did, somehow managed to get $5,000 in a bank, which is your buffer, or $3,000, whatever it was. And all of a sudden, you went to the bank, and Grandma O'Neill and Grandma Chief got her nose broken by the door hitting her in the nose, saying the bank's closed, you don't have your money anymore. So it was a wealth rip out of you. Same thing happened in 2007-8, where you bought a house for $235,000, which was the going rate at the time. You either put down $45,000, or your Pops O'Neill said, or Mom's O'Neill, or whatever, said, by the way, Kevin, you're a good kid, I like you, you didn't mess up too much as a kid, I'll give you your down payment. Okay, so now you took your inheritance and you put it in a house. All of a sudden, with all the crap that goes on in Washington, your house is now worth $170,000. Now the bank's still fine, or say $180,000. The bank's fine, but now you're 45. Your wealth, your savings, you and your wife's savings to put that down payment down, is now gone. You'd much rather be laid off a month, wouldn't you, than have your entire wealth stripped from you? It was a totally different thing.
I also see that whole housing and financing industry had a lot to do with the incredible reliance on mortgage-backed securities, everything that was going on there, because again, once you started to have people who could not pay their mortgages, could not refinance them, the alternative was once they started walking away, or once they were just foreclosed, the banks got all this inventory, which is non-earning assets. And if they aren't earning assets, then they aren't making money, and they can't move it. They couldn't get it off the books either. And it took a long, long time for that to wash through the system. So that was a big deal. And the foolishness of the reliance on mortgage-backed securities, and we can talk about this Friday. I have sort of my own, kind of history of it, that at least from my observations, that dates back to the 70s. It dates back to CRA and how CRA, which I thought was a good law at first and intended to be a good law, wound up being so abused in the way it started getting implemented that what we wound up with was a lot of people. There was easy money, and it wasn't their fault. I'm not saying all these stupid people, these bad people who all went out and got loans they couldn't afford. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that that the people who had them, worked on a promise that turned out to be a false promise, that it would be real easy. I can get you into the house now. If we do a 3-year or a 5-year balloon, I can get you at a really low rate. I can get you in at a low down payment, low to no down payment. And we can do all of this, and then you'll build up some equity, and things will all be better. And at the end of the balloon, you'll be able to refinance it. And even if you want to go to a more traditional mortgage, you can do it. Well, while all that was happening, we had all these other economic events, especially that rolled from starting late 2007 into early 2008, that just undermined that whole notion, and people were left holding the bag.
Well, you have people who.
Now you're right. It was a balance sheet because we stripped out their balance sheet.
But we also had people with a 7% mortgage that couldn't refinance. That it never missed a payment at 7%. And people said, oh, no, I can't give you a 3% loan because your place doesn't appraise. But
yeah, oh, exactly.
I mean, how screwed up is that?
Trauma is because there was so much inventory on the market that the values plummeted, and now I can't, yeah, I can't give you a loan at anything. But if you want to refinance traditional, you can't do it. You did, you know, you may have taken that for, you know, just to get in. But if you have to refinance because you took out a balloon, man, you're screwed.
Well, just if you had a regular mortgage, a lot of people who just walked away said, look, if you give me the 3% rate, which is now the going rate, I can stay. Not interested. See ya. I mean, which is the bank's issue. Anyway, we have I think we have Professor Russell with us. We also have a guest at 7:30. This will be interesting. Yuan, I think it's Yuan, Yuan Sinclair, and he's with Blair Hull's group that tries. We had the main Petra, I forgot her last name. Petra was on a while ago. She was a great guest. And what these guys are trying to do, how's this for a job, Kevin? To take variables from like all around the rest of the world, economic variables, political variables, whatever it is, population, and as well as stock market volatilities, all those kinds of things, and pile them into some kind of a model that basically says the market's overpriced, underpriced, or where you should buy in which industry. I can't wait to ask this guy how you put the stuff in from today's politicals going on a daily basis. This is going to be interesting as hell. But we do have Russell.
Yes, Russell. Good morning, Russell.
Russell, how are you?
I'm here.
Happy Sorry, we ran a little older, but
good morning.
We were just talking about the is what we're seeing now, especially in some of the automobiles, and it appears restaurants and bars took a big hit, retail sales this month. Is that a 1 month phenomenon? Is it ongoing? And if there's not as many new cars bought, what does that do to the used car market? And what does that do to be able to get be able to find a mechanic for your old junker? And how high are those prices going? I don't think our people in charge, Russell, have any idea how this stuff works its way through everything. Do you? Or if they do, they sure don't show it.
You mean as far as you know, people are not going out to eat and all that kind of stuff anymore?
Well, I'm saying if you screw up new car sales, give it 2 years. Now you've screwed up used car sales. You've screwed up.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, because of supply chain type stuff. Yeah, I think they would prefer that not happen. You know, where we don't have you know, funny anomalies like you know, a big supply of new cars but not enough used cars, except, you know, and then it flips back and forth. I don't know if that's a weird phenomena that goes back to the supply chain stuff from, you know, 4 years ago when you would have been. I always think of 4 years as your natural car replacement cycle for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's more like 10 now.
Yeah, I know. It can be 10. Or if you buy a Lexus, that's the last car you ever have to buy.
Good luck with that. So, yeah.
No, well, there was someone who bought a Lexus and like kept it going through almost 400,000 miles. And the Lexus people used to like highlight this guy, and then they realized, you know, if everybody follows this guy's lead, we're never going to sell another Lexus.
I think you could. I have sort of different views on that. Me being a kind of a car bluff. I think if these new cars, the new motors, the new oils, if you just drive them, I think, you know, 250, 300 in a car is almost easy now. But if it's 10 years old and you've got 30-odd computers and how many motors in the thing, they're going to drive you nuts with the windows not working, the seats not working, the roof,
the moonroof. You think the stuff's going
to
start breaking?
The stuff starts to break. That's what causes it. The moonroof, the back hatch that now has to be automatic. Try and get that fixed. $800, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I'm well aware. I just spent $5,000 on a new windshield.
You paid what? How much? Why?
because of the car that I drive.
Would you have to go to the Rolls dealership?
It's the Porsche dealership.
Oh, good. There you go.
So yes, I'm well aware of the Nifka. That was catching a rock in the windshield on the way home from Indiana. Cost of doing business.
What is a normal windshield cost these days? $500 or something?
Hey, honey, what was the at the discount places? How much would the windshield have been? It was like around $2,000.
Really? I mean,
No, hold on, what?
Oh, it was about 1,000, but it wouldn't have been installed correctly, and it wasn't worth the risk.
Ah, okay, well.
So there. Oh, well. So, yes, I'm well aware as to how much repair, you know, the parts and that kind of stuff.
Well,
and I want it done correctly. So
my nephew's wife, somebody rear-ended her, and they got a pretty mm-hmm. new, I think it's a Honda. So they take it to a place to get fixed. And, of course, the parts, if you don't buy the parts directly from Honda, which, of course, are four times as much as anybody else, mm-hmm. then they tell you that your warranty is no good on that area of the car or something. I mean, it's really, you know, it's kind of a game. Anyway, it's you know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on that caused people to pay mm-hmm. a lot, and it's I think when you get into the Porsche, you know you're kind of in the spot where they're the only place you're going
to
take it.
Yeah, no, I don't want to talk about it. I probably shouldn't even brought up the maintenance. It ain't cheap.
Well, Dan Janitas had the transmission go out in his Mercedes. They wanted $25,000, right, during COVID.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. So you had mentioned that before, and that popped in my mind when I was dealing with the expanding crack on my windshield. So there.
I got a good one for you about that. Dr. J gets he has the thing there, and of course they used to just when they expanded they'd go all at once and you'd hear the bzzz. Well, Jan gets, he's got the cracked windshield, so he's got to park in front of his house. And he calls up, he might have called Eminem, because those are the guys he played softball with, Jackie Putz. They did a great job. So they were coming over that day to put one in, right? So the local gendarme comes by and gives him a ticket for having a cracked windshield while it's parked.
Well, of course they
are. How is that not a moving violation? Anyway, hey, we're having Ewan Sinclair on. The last mm-hmm. half hour here, and these guys are trying to put together. I mean, Blair Hull was always a guy who tried to put as many things into the model as you know as possible. I mean, when I first started,
we had Blair speak at a Financial Management Association conference that I was on the host committee for years ago when he was just launching this. So I don't know. I know that they've evolved from what Blair was trying to do, but I haven't kept up with them too much. And then I know, and I've got all of his books. He's written some really good books on derivatives.
Well, it came down he first kind of made moves on the floor when I first started. If you traded in the Exxon pit or whatever, if somebody came in to buy Exxon calls and if somebody bought 50 of them or 50 Delta, you immediately went to New York and you bought 2,500 shares. You know, unless you were bullish or bearish, but you were in the game of making a market. You weren't in the game of ensuring somebody else's bet, essentially. So, and your only hedge was directly in front of you, right? But then you started to get indexes, and some people were trading IBM. I mean, before it was the OEX or even the S&P 500. If you want to be long the market, well, first you do you watch the bonds, okay, because they just come out. So if bonds are running up, meaning interest rates are going down, and you want to get long, you went and bought IBM, or maybe General Motors, and that was what you bought. And they were surrogates kind of the market. Well, all of a sudden, you started getting indexes and stuff. And Blair was one of the first guys that if kind of noticed that all of a sudden, if IBM starts going up a lot, or Digital, which was their biggest competitor at the time, or maybe even Hewlett-Packard or whoever else might have been around. If all of a sudden somebody starts buying IBM and it starts going up, these other ones are going to go up too. So Blair, if he ended up selling somebody 300 calls in IBM, he might also buy a little OEX. He might have to buy a little Digital, a little Hewlett. He constantly had an algorithm that people were constantly adjusting. If the industry is going to do really well today, is it just going to be IBM mm-hmm. or the other guy's going to come with it? Now, you know, obviously some days he's right, some days he's wrong. But he was one of the first people to advance from what I would call the direct hedge. Then it got into, he did his own auto quote and all kinds of other stuff once you get the systems rolling. But now this group, we had one guest on already, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to expand the variables even more to interest rates, to politics, to, I imagine, tariffs. I mean, some companies are going to affect some companies and some not. and trying to get a read on the market for on information that's out of the market itself. I mean, not just call volume, put volume, this stock movement, this technical, this fundamental. It's expanding it into, I'm dying to ask this guy, okay, what if we're at war? who gets to lob that variable in there? What do you do? I mean, I think the idea makes a whole hell of a lot of sense. Boy, Russell, I think we'd be pretty hard-pressed trying to put values on these variables, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. I think there are just certain things you just can't fully quantify. And then, you know, I know this is something that you're never really supposed to say as a professional investor, but you know, that I do feel like we have some situations that are new to the markets. You know, they say history repeats over and over again, and when you hear people say that something is different this time, that really should be a red flag. But you know, there are things in the world that are different. We haven't dealt with AI before. We haven't dealt with, you know, an alternate currency before. You know, we've got more countries that could wipe out their enemy instantly if they really wanted to, if they were okay with the repercussions behind it right now, than we've had before. India and Pakistan could basically do that to each other. If Putin loses his mind, he could do that to Ukraine and anybody else that's irritated him. And then, you know, Russia would be gone. Same thing with North Korea. So they're political risks that I think we've never had to deal with before. So I think that's a great line of questioning as far as.
But
how do you quantify these things? That have, I mean, maybe you. I know, like, USA Today has a fear index that's a combination of a few factors, which is very simplistic because we helped them create it when I was at SIBO, and Dix was part of it. But you know, how do you quantify what's going on in the world right now?
Well, it's a. Yeah. You know what I find, Russell, by the way, I wasn't very good in this class. There's only about eight of us, and I was the only one who didn't already have a heading for a PhD to go to work for an oil company. But it was integer programming and network flows. The difference between linear programming and quadratic programming and integer programming is the first two, if it's a decimal or a fraction, you're fine with it. These are serious maximum minimum problems, and they you know, they're pretty serious mathematics, and a lot of people use it. You know, and all your refineries and people like that all use it. But integer programming is another step up, because if you can't show up with half a pilot, it's got to be.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's so, gotta be, but I mean, yeah. So when you're talking about, let's say, even get the war talk away, there's a 20% chance of an asteroid hitting New York. Well, you can't factor 80 or 20. It's a binary event, right? It's either going to happen or it's not. So how do you?
Right, I mean, you can still factor over a long period of time. You know, if it's a recurring type.
Yeah, well, I don't think an asteroid in New York would be recurring.
That's kind of the point I was trying to make with the number of nuclear armed countries we've got out there. You know, that those types of things are not. You know, they're not recoverable from, and they're not necessarily. We're never going to be the same after something like that.
Well, the last two days, I mean, we didn't realize that evidently that we're at war with Iran. We're demanding an unconditional surrender, and we didn't even know we were fighting them. But I mean, I don't know. It's just another thing out of our leader's mouth that'll be retracted tomorrow. I don't know how you're at war and come back being retracted, but.
I was really afraid that Israel was getting ready to do something just absolutely massive last night.
Well,
I felt like that's what was, and you know, Iran is just about out of bullets. They've used almost all of their, assuming that Israel hasn't taken out any of their missiles, which I think is a terrible assumption. They've got less than 1,000 left, and they're shooting hundreds a night at Israel. So Iran is almost in a situation now where they've got, you know, no air force to repel Israel, and they're getting ready to run out of missiles that they can launch at Israel, and there's nowhere for them to get new ones.
China?
Yeah, I think China appears to be sitting this one out, although there was a big transport plane that was scheduled to go from, I think, Shanghai to somewhere in Europe, and it just decided to stop in Iran.
There's two of them. They turned off their,
two of them?
They turned off their transponder.
And I assume there are a couple assumptions on that. Either they sent them a bunch of stuff to try and help, or they sent them some planes and people are going to get on them and leave.
Well, I
know some people have been people with wherewithal have been escaping to Russia.
Well, a couple of times now, and one of them was a few years ago, and I think there was one, maybe you can remember, where was I yesterday? Couldn't, I think this is the second time that Iran has gotten, I'll say, pretty blustery, and Israel has gone over and done something to their nuclear facilities, and Iran.
Yeah, they've set them back a couple of times, yeah, and but it was,
and Iran lobs
it was
over.
It was one big strike, and that was it.
Yeah, you know, and then Iran would lob, you know, essentially some scuds or better scuds, and they'd land a few spots, and unfortunately, a few people were hurt and killed, and Israel would say, "Okay, that's a, we're happy with that response," and basically, you slap them back in the corner for like, well, that's horrible thing to say, for another 5 or 10 years, and they go about building the stuff up again, and I think the market, boy, I don't want to be one of the knuckleheads who says their market is agreeing with their opinion, but it appears to me the market is taking it a little bit in stride, and I think the market's opinion is that's what's going to happen this time.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you have somebody saying, we want an unconditional surrender, and you better evacuate Tehran, and it's somebody not even, well, we know we're sort of involved, but it's not been admitted by anybody that we're actually at war with Iran that I know of. Do you think the Senate's heard about this? I don't think so. And all of a sudden we want, whoever we are, an unconditional surrender from somebody we don't even know we were fighting. So now, does that mean that gets retracted tomorrow if all of a sudden the thing just cools down and we forget the guy said it? Or what are we doing here? I mean,
I don't know. This adds another wrinkle to
this whole mess. I thought it was dying down like you. Iran's kind of out of bullets. I didn't think
it was dying down. I thought Israel was just going to continue to pound them.
Well, they're worried about big place that they need a bunker buster to get at. That appears to be the... But they could say, okay, we got the top people, we got most of it. We'll lay off for 6 months and see what they do. If they start scrambling back to get it all going again, well, maybe we got to get the bunker buster. But I
think some of what Trump was saying, when he was saying unconditional surrender, he also was saying to the Ayatollah, we know exactly where you are. He keeps saying that. We know exactly where you are. I don't know if you've, I think I've told the funny story about apparently Trump over in Afghanistan, and he said, you know, we're going to start withdrawing, but if a single American soldier is hurt, et cetera, I'm going to hold you personally responsible. And Trump showed the guy a satellite photo of his house.
How much of that is real, or how much of that is just him?
But just, you know, assume that he acts like that in a roundabout way sometimes. And I took that one to say, you don't want to bring us into this because we will take you out instantly. That's really, I felt like he was saying, don't shoot at the Americans.
I'm sure that's the message.
I really felt like it was more of that than we're at war with you. But I felt like it was more of all of that bluster stuff was more of a warning to not mess around with us. Even though I don't know this for a fact or anything, but you've got to assume that we've been helping shoot down some of these things.
Oh yeah. Well, certainly we get with the satellites for sure.
Yeah, everybody. Well, but part of it is everybody forgets we've got people, we've got bases in Iraq, and that's what's between Iran and Israel. You know, I mean, those things were going over us or over our bases, so of course we're going to shoot at them.
Well, they either got to go over Iraq or Syria or someplace. I mean, the closest. I actually looked this up. The closest. Border between the two is like 1,100 miles between Israel and Iran. But if you want to drive it, it's 1,300. You think we should go over and take that drive? What would we have to do? Get an old Toyota pickup truck and put
it? I just got a brand new windshield. I'm sure it would hold up for the drive.
No, you got to get an old Nissan or Toyota pickup truck, and we got to put a machine gun in the back, right?
Put a big old seat in the back. Yeah.
Yeah, you got a machine gun, but yeah, I mean, I think obviously most people would like to see Iran, you know, sneak back in their cave for another 5 years and be monitored. And I mean, from an economic.
I think it's time to have some different people in charge of Iran.
Okay, now you gotta be careful with that. It was a big.
I know they gotta be careful with that, but there is a religious aspect to all of this, and there's a hardcore version of Islam that believes that they're supposed to destroy Israel. It's the catalyst for some things that their religion believes.
History to that, according mm-hmm. to one person. Did you ever? Got to go to break here at some point because we have you on time. But there's a. Did you ever read a book or see the History Channel thing? On the book's name is Catastrophe. It has to do with a massive eruption. Well, they didn't know what it was. I'll be real brief with this, if I can be. Some guy like us, Russell, he's sitting in somebody's place over in Britain, and evidently over in Britain, a piece of furniture is, they like having tops that are a huge tree that's been sawed, and you get like a one-inch thing of the trunk, and you varnish it all up, and that becomes your coffee table top. Have you ever seen one of those? It was big for a while. So the guy's over there having a few pints, and he's just looking at this thing and looking at it closer and closer. Finally gets out a magnifying glass, and he starts counting back the years, and there's a spot there where there's like 5 to 10 years where the rings are very narrow. And he's like, what the bleep happened there? And he counts back to like 500-something A.D., and then he checks more and checks more and checks more and starts doing all his research. And he finds out that for that period of, you know, 3 to 10 years or whatever it was, the world was amazingly cold and nothing's growing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, actually the British military back way down the line helped them out find that it was some sort of it wasn't an asteroid hit, it was some kind of an eruption somewhere in the Pacific that just darkened the skies for like forever. And so all this stuff happened. And one of the things that happened was everybody was pretty much starving. And you see stuff like people's castles used to be on certain place, and all of a sudden they're near the water so they could fish. Places that used to be horse dominant are now cattle dominant because cattle can last when there's not enough grass because horses can't. What anyway, it goes through this whole list. But one of the things was that the Romans started to have all kinds of problems. They get the plague and everything. Enter Muhammad. And his dad's got nothing but grain storages, so they make it everybody's listening to the kid. And now, according to this guy, and I'm no expert on Muslim religion, their whole attitude was, we not only have this new religion, it's our job to go make sure other people believe us or not. I mean, it's somewhat similar, but not. Catholic religion never quite got there in the Dark Ages, but they were sort of close, where, you know, if you're not Catholic, we're going to come conquer you. But the Muslims, I think, still believe it. And there's no difference between religion and government, which is clearly not our way. And you know that's a problem. That's our fundamental difference, right? I mean, basically. Hey, we can chance stuff, but let's go a quick break, and we'll bring you on.
Quick break,
and then we'll because the market's doing nothing here. Market's in a holding pattern, like you and I are talking. Like the world's in a holding pattern here, right? S&P futures up 7.
They're waiting for everybody is breathlessly waiting.
Yeah, but then does anybody even care about the Fed thing today? S&P futures up 7.
That's what they're breathlessly waiting on.
Ah,
go to break.
NASDAQ futures up 40. Be right back. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market, It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello, don't face Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Mao. Andrew on the board. SP futures up 6. NASDAQ futures up 41. Dow up 46. Nothing really moving in the Dow here. I got IBM up $1.72. IBM's been a big mover this year. Who would have thunk it? But it's been one of the best stocks. Over in Europe, we've got DAX down 59.2%. FTSE up 10.1%. CAC around down 7. I call that one flat. Over in Asia, so not much going on between the rhetoric yesterday on the war and the Fed meeting today. We're cautiously waiting, it appears. We're not sure for what, but we are waiting. We're going to find out for what from our guest here in a second. The rest of the stuff isn't moving all that much. Let me just check oil here real quick. Oil's up 39 cents, 75.23. Russell, 2 weeks ago, we were saying oil at 61. It's been here so long, it's getting boring. It's going to break out one way or the other. Why didn't we do something? Like, it's up like 25%, for God's sake. But we did not. Andrew, why don't you give us traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is 7:33 here in Chicago. Just a little bit of sports. The Cubs won with the Brewers. It's 5-3, while the White Sox lost to the Cardinals. Blowout here, 12-2. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 67 degrees. It's going to be a little bit cooler throughout the day. Going to have some pretty spotty thunderstorms all throughout and heavy rain. We have a watch for flash flooding, hail, and localized damaging wind gust throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 76. Over in Phoenix, they have a heat warning right now. They're at 83 degrees, and they're going to have a high of 113. Finally, for Chicago traffic, looks like just traffic is building on the major expressways. We do have one accident to report that's on the Edens, heading south right before Cicero Avenue. A little bit of delays there, but other than that, it's about business as usual. Back to you, Chief.
Do we have you on Sinclair?
Indeed.
Hey, how are you? Andrew, you got to turn him up a hair. How are you on this great rainy day?
I'm doing all right. I mean, at least it's warm. We've been waiting for that for a while.
Yeah. Ewan Sinclair works with Hull Tactical Asset Allocation. He's a option trader, 30 years of professional experience, PhD in theoretical physics, wow, from the University of Bristol. Has written 3 books, Volatility Trading, Option Trading, and Positional Option Trading. And before I hopefully let you and Russell, the two geniuses, talk here, I'm going to drop back real quick to when I was young and people were doing option modeling when options were new. Options started in 1973 and I was in grad school in, say, 77. And the guys who did the original option modeling were guys that I had classes from at the University of Chicago. And to try and put an option model together, it was designed to be easily put on whatever computers were in the day. And the idea was virtually all the stuff, the politics, all those other kinds of things, essentially right, they were in the price of the stock itself. And all the other, then when you try to make the option modeling as simple as possible, and one of the things you did was to make assumptions that there was a steady flow of information, a continual flow of information regarding the market and regarding your individual stock you're talking about, which of course turned out to be happy hooey, because we know it's pretty much, it's not continual, it's pretty discrete, especially in earnings days and things like that. So as time went by, some people started to say, well, there's a lot of other variables that affect not only the market and the individual stock and the volatility. What is the volatility? When's it high? When's it low? And we all know it's high the day before earnings, and it drops the day after an individual stock. And guys like Russell, who's written books on volatility, and Yuan, have taken this to some extreme level to where they're actually saying this other stuff really not only does matter to the price of the stock, but maybe the price of the options and maybe the market movement. And I'm dying to hear kind of where you are in that. I'm trying to figure out, you had, how the hell an hour ago in the show we're talking about, we got to ask this guy, if we got a 20% chance of nuking Tehran, how does that fit into your model? Where does that go?
Well, I mean, I was listening to you guys before, and I don't want to sound rude here, but, you know, I have a talent for sounding rude, so, you know, you
That's fine.
Me on.
You belong on the show if you sound rude. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we may as well talk about the Cubs, to be honest. I mean, the chances of a bunch of guys like us sitting around and figuring out what Tehran and, you know, Tel Aviv are going to do is minimal.
Yep.
There's no real evidence anyone can trade consistently and make money off that stuff. Now, I'm not saying I don't do it, because it's interesting, and I've read the book Catastrophe, and it was fascinating. It was the same guy who did Guns, Germs, and Steel. But I just don't think it's the way to try to make money. Whereas going back to what you said about options, the interesting thing about options to me is it's a relative value trade. It's always a relative value trade. You're just saying, if the stock is doing this, then the options have to be doing that. So in a way, it's the same as, you know, doing a futures spread or something. It's just that the spread is much more dynamic and things have to be adjusted much more often. And so I think it's much more likely you're going to find dislocations and opportunities in relative value trades like that, mainly because there are a lot more relative value trades in the world, and they're not as picked over. Whereas, you know, trying to outguess the S&P based on, you know, whatever's going on in the news is really difficult. Now, I'm not saying you can't do it. Some people clearly have done it. I just think, and we're all gamblers here, right? I just think it's a bad bet to take. You're putting an awful lot of effort into the hardest game in the world, whereas I think if the idea is to make money, then you want to find an easy game.
When you say relative value, and Russell, feel free to pile in, are you saying you might find that the Russell, for instance, is cheap compared to the Qs or something, or the NASDAQ? I mean, is that, or are you talking about individual stocks or all of the above?
Well, all of the above. And this is one of the things I think you really have to do as a trader, is you have to have a really good idea about what normal means, because inefficiencies do pop up, and by definition, though, they're abnormal. So it's no use you looking at something for the first time and saying, this looks weird. You've got to have a sort of a mental, at least mental, database of what normal is. Like, so if you look back a few weeks, when things were going crazy, you know, the start of the tariffs stuff, the S&P vol was way over the NASDAQ vol. Now, that just doesn't happen, right? Now, I'm not saying that that automatically means you do a spread there, but it certainly means that's the place where you start to look. When you're like, look, this spread is normally like, you know, the ratio is normally like, I don't know, 0.9. It's just blown out to 1.05. What does that mean? So I think, you know, and I hate to get into this argument about markets aren't efficient, those guys are stupid. Well, I mean, those guys weren't stupid. The whole idea was to come up with something better than we had before, and they did. But when people say the markets are inefficient, sometimes people then think, oh, it means every market's 90% efficient, and that's just not true. I think what you'll find is very few instances something is completely inefficient. So I think most of the time, most things are completely efficient, but there are certainly situations out there, and you need to have a wide enough idea of what the world normally looks like to be able to find those situations. So yeah, the NASDAQ, S&P, sure, that can go out of line, in the options. The VIX options can go out of line with the S&P options. You know, anything like that.
Well, you know, we have, have some access, but I used to have access to the, you know, one of those things where everybody who buying calls on the offer, buying puts on the, you know, on the offer, selling them on the bid, that kind of thing, where you're trying to get some sort of a, and it was pretty fascinating to me to watch how many times people make some huge trade that, well, to me, is like zero chance of going anywhere, but people do it. It's sort of like an Armageddon trade, where if somebody were to go out, say, in the SPYs, which you're talking about, and buy, you know, 300, which SPY is trading 598. So somebody goes out and buys a year out, you know, 300,000 of the 500 puts, for instance. It wouldn't surprise me, because I hang around with some guys that are in the business of, you know, doing the other side of these trades. It wouldn't surprise me that it wouldn't take them a week to sort of catch up with their hedge, and that the vol and the spider would be a little higher than it normally would be vis-a-vis the Qs, just because that's where somebody, whoever the somebody is, did that trade. I mean, is that the kind of thing you're, I mean, it's not like, I don't think the people who are modeling it one day decide to go out, hey, let's make this irregularity. You think it's driven by somebody making a trade like that, the difference in volume back and forth?
Yeah, that absolutely happens, right? And, you know, we've all been around, and we know way back, you know, the big thing around expiration was pinning, right? Because, you know, the people's feedback from their hedges, the longs would get more and more aggressive, buying low below the strike and selling above the strike, and the feedback from that would definitely be a pinning effect. And that happens not just at expiration, you know, it happens based on every trade. The problem with it is, in most cases, it's like what I said before, in most cases it's a very, very minor effect. You know, we tend to, because we're so deep in the options world, I think we tend to forget sometimes what a backwater they are in finance. You know, the 95% or 99% or, God, I don't know the number, something very high of trades have nothing to do with options. So we can sometimes overestimate the effect, the size of that effect. You know, and there are plenty of services out there who'll say, oh, the market makers are long this or long that, so the stock won't do this or won't do that. But again, it's just a very hard game to
play. How much, if any, and Russell, I'd love your opinion on this as well. But one of my good buddies is a risk manager for one of these, you know, big firms that has, you know, they make markets and everything, or not everything, but a lot of stuff. And some of the rules and margins and minimums on even these guys is something that you think are pretty arcane. I know when a while ago, Nvidia and a few of these other big stocks had their splits, all of a sudden they were massive buyers of stuff. Because if you were, there's a $25 minimum or something on every option, even if it's a million miles away. So if they had, you know, 500 of the way out of the money calls or puts in Nvidia, now all of a sudden they've got 5,000, because I think it was a 10-to-1 split, and their margin requirements are to the moon, so they become net buyers on stuff. So it wouldn't surprise me if that, just because of I'll use the term arcane clearing rules, that would drive the VIX up for a while, or at least the volatility in Nvidia. And by the way, what you're talking about is, when that happens, it's up to you and us to take advantage of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good example. When a regulatory thing, or in your case, a split, which leads to a regulatory thing, when that happens, that really does lead to opportunities. Absolutely. I've got a friend who's basically, his entire trading methodology consists of reading prospectuses of structured products and ETFs. You know, and these are boring and are long, but there are things in there. You know, there are loopholes in there that you can take advantage of. And again, not all the time. And if you're trying to figure out what's happening to Nvidia on the morning that happens, you're probably not going to be able to keep up. But if you're aware that that's a game that gets played, then that's a huge opportunity. I mean, we saw that back 2018, when the leveraged VIX products got deleveraged. You know, there's a bunch of opportunities there as stuff was unwound and, you know, brokers increased their margin requirements and... I would put that in the list of things people definitely should be looking at. I mean, instead of trying to guess what is Apple mispriced today, well, I mean, again, that's a super hard problem. But if you know there's a lot of forced buying or a lot of forced selling because people have to meet margin requirements, you know, that's the sort of place you should be hunting for opportunities.
So it's not up to you to say, well, Apple should be worth, you know, 150 or 250. It's, if all of a sudden something affects Apple to where, on a relative basis, it gets shoved down compared to its, I'll use the term, competitors, you might want to be, this is almost like a, I mean, remember the guys that used to do the pairs trading?
Oh, sure.
This is kind of this is like a very sophisticated way. I mean, for those that don't know what that is, for some people, and actually we had a couple guys on the show, they used to always pairs trade Exxon versus Chevron. That the normal spread is whatever it was, $20 or something. When it got to 25, you bought one and sold the other. When it got to 15, you did the opposite. Until one day, they never came back together. But I mean, it's you're not going to win all the time, right? The idea is just to find an anomaly. When I first started in the business, you and Russell, we used to do what they call neutral spreading, where if somebody came in, there wasn't anywhere near as big of a market. So if somebody went in and bought the IBM, 200 calls, they might drive the volatility of the 200 calls up to 22, where the 195s were 17. There weren't people like Blair and people that immediately would look to even that up. So maybe you'd buy one, sell two, and try and stay neutral. You know, it was a volatility play between options and an individual stock. But now that game is gone. But you still can get it. Like for this Friday, for instance, the day off tomorrow, in the midst of all the political stuff. And I agree with you that for us to try and figure out what or who is going to do where in Tehran or somebody else. But what you probably can look at and say, okay, we've got news tomorrow. It's going to be something. The volatility on Friday is probably going to be a little higher than just a normal summer Friday. Now the question is it too high or too low, right? Because there's some chance, a little more than normal, of some sort of an event happening between tonight's close and Friday's opening. Now, if there's no increase in volatility, I would think you might say there should be some. maybe we should go long volatility, but if it's to the moon, maybe it's way too much and we should try and go short, but then that's a problem too. Is that kind of am I getting to sort of the right thing?
Yeah, you've covered like three things in there that are all really good examples. So market making is entirely a relative value trade, right? You know, you buy the 10 delta calls a little bit too cheap, you sell the 15 delta calls for value, you've locked in a tiny amount of money. And the good thing about options is you've got thousands of different things you can spread things off against. So the margins are all really small, but you don't really have to have a massive view on any one thing. You're just looking for spreads. You know, and if you think back in the options world, right, who are the people who made the real money? You know, and they're all the big market-making firms. Like, market-making and options, I mean, it's got tougher. Everything gets tougher, right? I don't know a single thing where people are like, man, this is so much easier than it used to be. But I think that's a really good example. And your other example about, you know, is volatility fairly priced over this holiday? I mean, the answer is almost always no. Whenever you've got a situation where there's an uncertain outcome but a certain timing, volatility is almost always overpriced. You know, it's like around earnings, around the FOMC, over weekends, over holidays. And particularly now, I mean, what's your first thought? You'd have to be crazy to sell options expiring on Friday, right?
Yeah.
You know, there could be a nuclear war start tomorrow. But if you're thinking that, everyone else is thinking that, and order flow is going to make those options too expensive. So it's a risk premium, right? And the only way to get a risk premium is to take some damn risk. So you've got to have bigger balls than the market, but, you know, if you're prepared to take the risk, and I'm not saying that tomorrow is going to work out, because like you say, you're not going to be right every time, but I think that's where the edge is. Where people go wrong with risk premium is they try and harvest it without taking any risk. You know, they're like, oh, I've got to sell the straddle, but now I've got to buy three of the five delta calls because I don't want this to happen, this to happen. And if you hedge all the risk you can see, you're just not going to have any money left.
I used to trade behind a guy in the OEX for 20 years, you and Danny Callahan, terrific guy. And one day he says, you know, if I'm perfectly hedged, how do I make any money?
Absolutely. And the other thing is, right, and you guys all know this because you're dinosaurs like me, and I say that proudly because the dinosaurs lived an awful long time, right? If you ever have a position and you're like, I just don't see any way I can lose money here, that's really dangerous, right? Because you know there is.
Oh, sure there is.
Don't know,
well,
don't know what it is.
You could have put a, back in the day when interest rates were really high, you could put a reversal on for the right price and just wait for your interest check to come in. I mean, in those days, you could lock stuff up like that, but even then, if it moved enough and you got it signed, well, yeah, there's always a way, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're riding the rowboat, right?
Except I have a specific
can sink.
How about a specific trading question for you? Because, you know, I think we still have Russell. I've noticed, and again, I don't have anywhere near the computer capability you guys do. By the way, I also want you to be able to say what you guys do, and if somebody wants to put money in, you got to be able to do that. That's why you're on. I've noticed we do a lot of earnings plays, or at least I look at all of them. And every time a stock has an earnings play, it's just what we were talking about earlier, it's a discrete event. It's not an everyday occurrence for a stock. Well, it's four times a year. And if you look at the straddle, it's essentially the market's view of where the break-even is and where the thing's going to move, right? And so I look at that all the time, and it seems like for years, you know, if you could have sold all of them, which of course you're never going to do for a retail trader, and oh, by the way, you're going to have some, you know, some blips in there where you're going to get your ass kicked, but if you sold all of them, you'd probably be ahead. Like that the sellers might have a slight advantage only because retail people couldn't do it over the buyers. It seems like the last couple of years, if I could have gone back and went long every straddle, I'd be way ahead. I mean, in the last 3 weeks, the earnings, there's been, I can name you like five or six stocks that moved two and three times straddle. I don't think I've ever seen that before. Is that because Russell thinks that it's because the companies aren't given out as much information as they used to? There's more, quote, surprises. Have you noticed it, or am I just my brain isn't actually getting the real figures? I'm just getting my impressions. Have you kind of noticed that the market is having trouble? It seemed like for years, if the straddle was $12, miraculously the thing moved 11 to 13. You know, market knew everything, and now it seems like market's not as smart. Or am I just seeing wrong stuff?
The short bull trade over earnings has been really it's been really good. I wouldn't say really consistent, right? It's been really good for a long time. This season was actually really good, but you nailed the point. You've got to do all of them. Picking and choosing is really tough. And, you know, if you remember NVIDIA from a few years ago, I mean, that was, you know, I remember I didn't have an NVIDIA position on, but I was short some Qs, call options, that expired that day. And we went through seven strikes in the Qs purely because of NVIDIA.
Yeah.
You know, and you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not going to remember all the little wins. So this past season, the shorts really should have cleaned up. But if you pick and choose the big names, yeah, they seem to have got... I would say that the big names, you know, towards the top of the S&P 500 have got more efficient, and possibly, and I haven't measured this, possibly there is an edge to going long those now. But I think if you trawl further down the list, being short is still the way to go there. I'd like to hear Russell's take on that.
Yeah, Russell.
And by the way, Russell, hi. Yep. I'm not sure we've ever run across each other in person, but I think
we have. We met once right out of outside of the door of SIBO, and I introduced myself, and you could have cared less. which is okay because, you know, I think you were like in the you were in like your little I'm walking to work and you were in a zone or something, and I think I kind of startled you, but I did introduce myself when I was at SIBO once a million years ago, and then I think we're both a little bit familiar with each other. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna step on Chief here because we're gonna run out of time, and I want to give you a chance to talk about what you guys are doing at Hull. And for full disclosure, I had him speak at an academic conference that I used to be involved with, the thing that they run at SIBO every year in conjunction with FMA. And he came in and talked about what you got. In fact, I have like the poster from it in my office at Indiana. But he talked about what, and he was in the early days of what he was doing. Has it evolved much? But talk about what you guys are doing, because that's one of the reasons that you're here, and we're going to run out of time.
Well, you know what? We started 5 minutes late, so we're going to go five over.
Okay.
So,
yep. Okay. We're going to give them some time, too. But I want to make sure you get a chance to talk about what you want to talk about. That's all. So,
yeah, this is the problem when you get three old traders in a room, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm trying to steer us a bit.
Yeah, so. I appreciate that. So back when I said that predicting the price of the S&P was really hard, that's what we're trying to do. We're doing it in a way that we're accepting that it's hard, and instead of trying to find, you know, one really strong signal, we're combining like 30 different signals that we know all have very weak predictability, and we're coming up with a composite signal from that and adjusting our position either longer or shorter every day. And we've done pretty well over the last, we've beaten the market over the last 1, 3, and 5 years in terms of Sharpe ratio. And I've come on to add sort of volatility, you know, enhancements to that. We've got three different vol strategies in there now. We've got a risk reversal strategy. We've got a VIX spread strategy, and we have zero DTEs in there as well. But the guts of the model is this market timing prediction model, which is based on all these little micro alphas. And I think a lot of traders will, well, a lot of retail guys starting out, they come up with a signal and it's like, works 52% of the time, and they're like, oh man, if only I was better, if I was as good as the pros, I'd get a signal that was 60% of the time. But you're not going to find that signal, and it's not a reflection on you. It's just a statement that strength of signal doesn't exist. But if you can accept the 51% signals, well, you can bind 20 of those and you're good to go. So it's a matter of having the computer power and the infrastructure to do that. So I wouldn't try and do this myself, but you know, if we've got like 15 people working here, and it does work, and we're trying to provide that in a publicly available package. So, you know, if people want a slightly enhanced version of the S&P as their core holding instead, that's what our ETF HTUS is designed to do.
So it's designed for somebody who normally might be, you know, come to a place like PTI and say, I want to put, you know, this much in the spiders. Instead of putting in the spiders or the Qs, they're going to put them with you guys because there's some sort of a enhancement in there. But still, you're pretty. Would you say you're pretty much always long or not, or you're not always?
Well, we're aiming to be a beta one product. And we don't volatility target, but that's sort of where we're aiming to be. Technically, we can go between flat and long 200. In practice, we're normally either 80% invested up to 120% invested. We never go short, but we can be flat. But that would take an extreme situation where all of our indicators are basically heavily negative.
You got some pretty smart people on your site. You've identified 30 things that pretty much everybody would shake their head and say, yeah, that should be in there. Whose job is it to weigh them all? How do you do that?
Well, that's the thing that computers are really good at. We've got essentially a big augmented regression model. So, you know, just like linear regression plots the relationship between two things, we've got a non-linear regression with a bunch of other tweaks in it that does all that, and it gives each signal, and you know, we'll tell you what the signals are. I mean, these are signals we all know mean something, like the FOMC announcement, unemployment, CPI, the yield curve. There's nothing in there that you'll be like, wow, no one has ever done that before. I mean, we get most of the stuff from papers and experience, and you know, there's stuff in there that people talked about 30 years ago, like put call ratios and stuff.
How do you one of the most difficult you know, in all the years, the most difficult times that I've had reading the market, for whatever stupid term that is, I've always had trouble when the good news is bad news and bad news is good news stuff. How do you guys deal with that?
Yeah, that's really tough, actually, isn't it? And you see that with, you know, with relationship, like, what's gold doing if the market goes up? You know, what's the relationship between bonds and stocks? That's really difficult, because if something's worked for like 40 years and then it's going into a bad patch for 2 years, deciding when to turn something off is difficult. So our models are adaptive. So as something starts to not work for 2 years, it gradually gets less and less weight. And that's sad, and that would be really bad if you had one signal. But if you have a whole bunch of them, hopefully the other one, if everything went to pieces together, that would be the end of the game. But that doesn't happen. So again, we don't make the ingredients, we're just good cooks. We just put all this stuff together and then let the math kind of work itself out.
So if we're in a situation where all of a sudden the labor report is horrible and everybody goes, okay, that means the president's going to beat up on Powell even more and there's going to be an emergency rate cut, the flip side of the news, that's the part you're saying that is very difficult to deal with. I mean, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, when things change, right, and like you go from good news being bad news to good news being good news, that's something you can't really pick up. And I think it's fair, you know, you said you had trouble with it. Well, the reason you had trouble with it is perfectly reasonable, right? It's because you were looking to see what happened in the past. And once the past is a bad guide to the future, you've really got nothing to go on, right? I mean, in everything in the world, you can either bet that what has happened before will continue to happen, or that it won't continue to happen. And, you know, just very quick thinking about it, the way to bet is that the past is a guide to the future. Otherwise, we just may as well give up. But when that stops being the case in a given variable, there really isn't a lot you can do about it, rather than just, you know, hit the desk and then go and take the dog for a walk.
All right, so how does somebody find you, what you guys are doing? Is it, you go to this Hull Tactical Asset Allocation, just Google that and you pop up?
Yeah, that would bring you to our site. Our ticker is HTUS. It should be available on most of the major platforms. But yeah, and also if you feel free to email us, give us a call. We're always pleased to talk about it. I mean,
somebody could call up.
About this forever.
Somebody could call up PTI Securities, my firm, and say, "I want to buy some," and we buy it for you, right?
Absolutely. And if you're gonna buy a big block, you know, because it's an ETF, we can do a create, and the transaction costs are completely minimal at that point.
Okay, you and I loved it. I'd love to have you back. You and Russell, I'm the brain fog here is above me, which is fine. It's always you never learn anybody unless you talk to people smarter than you. But thank you very much. I'd love to have you back on, Russell. As usual, you're the best, buddy.
I'm thrilled that you got going on. I really am, and I did not take that personal that day. It's when he was doing a personal introduction, he said sometimes he can come across as being harsh. I was just piling on that just a little bit.
So you don't have a UN poster in your room with a dart in it?
I do. I'm a big fanboy. I fully admit it.
So. Yeah, it's not like I act like a dick. I really am a dick.
And you own it, and that's wonderful.
With that note, we have to no show tomorrow because we're off, but we'll be back on Friday to talk all about it. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, guys. Back on Friday, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.